Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, March 15th, 2021, and I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria. We've got a good one for you, as usual, but before we dive in, I want to thank those of you who continue to make Talk Nerdy possible and, of course, 100% free to download. The top patrons this week are Mary Neva, Michael Gaucher, Brian Holden, Christopher Pitts, Daniel Lang, David J.E. Smith, Dudas Infinitas, June Sapara, Leonard Prince, Pasquale Gelati, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Scott Sanders, Ulrika Hagman, Elise Christie, and of course, Robert Christ. Wow, that list is getting long. This is incredible. Thank you so much from the bottom of my heart. If you want to hear your name at the top of the show, or you just want to support in another way, all you've got to do is visit patreon.com/talknerdy. You can also visit carasantamaria.com or talknerdy.com, where you will learn other ways to support, like rating and reviewing anywhere you get your podcast and shopping in the Talk Nerdy store. All right, let's dive into this week's episode. This is a good one, you guys. So I got to sit down with Dr. Julia Lane to talk about her newest book, and she has written many. This one's called Democratizing Our Data, A Manifesto. So Dr. Julia Lane is a founder of the Coleridge Initiative. She's a professor at the NYU Wagner Graduate School of Public Service and the NYU Center for Urban Science and Progress. And she's an NYU Provostial Fellow for Innovation Analytics. She has a longstanding career as a trained economist and, of course, moved over into the public sector and in public service. She knows so much. She is absolutely fascinating. And we're going to talk today about why it's so important that we take an evidence-based approach to policy and how we can better collect big data in a safe way, in a way that serves us all. So without any further ado, here she is, Dr. Julia Lane. Well, Julia, thank you so much for joining me today.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Yes, of course. I'm really excited to talk about your newest book, Democratizing Our Data, A Manifesto. What an important topic. When this came across my desk, I was thrilled and I immediately said, I want to make sure that we have a conversation about this. You know, actually, before we get into the book, even though I have so many questions, but before we get into the book, maybe tell the listeners a little bit more about what you do, what it means to be an economist, and your specific area of focus.
That's a great question. So I am an economist by training, but kind of have turned into a great title for your podcast. I've turned into a data nerd, I guess. I started my career as an academic economist. That's a really big hit at cocktail parties, as you can imagine. Hey, what do you do? I'm an academic economist. Look for the exits. The challenge that I faced was, you know, you can really only answer questions if you have the data to answer them, at least evidence-based questions. And I kept getting boxed in where the data that was being kind of handed to me didn't answer the questions I was interested in. And so what I ended up doing was, close to 20 years ago now, I was interested in answering kind of a really important question back then, and it still is now, like, what is the return to investment in training? Very simple question, but, you know, I'm a labor economist, so I think about earnings and employment and career trajectories and economic mobility, things that still resonate today. And in order to figure out the return to investment on training, what you need to do is you need to have data on both firms and workers. Right? And you should care about training because so much of the work that's done is about education, but that's like K through 12 or K through 20.
Right.
And
it's not specialized.
And not only that, but, you know, we're done at 22, at age 22, and we've got another 40, 45 years. And so much of learning is on the job. And the, incentive of firms is that they're going to underinvest in on-the-job training because people can, if you train people up a lot, they're gonna move.
Right.
Because the training
to another job.
Exactly. The training is embodied in the human being. There's no collateral, right? I can't like chain you to a desk. well, as we speak.
You shouldn't chain one
you
to
shouldn't
a desk.
Chain one to a desk. And if you did, you know, you probably wouldn't get much out of them. But unlike the kids, but that's another story. So the challenge is you want to understand how to incentivize firms to provide on-the-job training, how to incentivize workers to invest in training that might also benefit just the firm and not them. So there's kind of this split. So how can you figure out what the return is to investment in training for both workers and firms? Well, in order to answer that question, you need data on both. And most data sets that I was looking at either had data on firms or on workers, but not both. So I thought, well, if you're going to really answer this important question, you need to combine the two. And so that's kind of where I headed. And I built this national program called it's somewhat turgid, Longitudinal Employer Household Dynamics Program. But what was different about that is it used something called administrative records. So it wasn't survey data. It was data that is what they call found, not made. So that means it's generated from the administration of government programs. And it turned out to be an incredibly powerful infrastructure because it enabled you to look at the dynamic interaction of workers and firms, which is also known as a job, right? So you could look at workers over time, look at firms over time, look at their jobs, and look at the earnings and employment. So that created a whole new way of looking at the labor market. Okay. So did that. It's been an incredibly powerful infrastructure, but there hasn't been a lot since. And so a few years ago, when there was an increasing focus on the lack of data to answer big questions, and particularly a recognition that survey data were increasingly costly, the response rates were deteriorating, and they really weren't designed to answer a lot of important questions at the scale that we wanted to. The federal government set up this Commission on Evidence-Based Policymaking, and they asked me to help.
And when was that?
That was in 2016. The Commission on Evidence-Based Policymaking.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I started to think about, well, why don't we get better data? Data are fundamental to the functioning of our society. It's in the opening part of the Constitution that they're going to count the population. And, you know, it sounds trite, but it's true. If you don't count, if you're not counted, you don't count. So if I don't know that you're African-American, or if I don't know that you're Hispanic, or if I don't know that you're LGBTQ, you don't count because you don't have a voice. If I don't know that you're marginalized, if I don't know that you're drug addicted, I can't design anything or any policies to help. And so then I started to think, okay, so why don't we have the data? And what are the problems? And how can we democratize our data? Because it's foundational to our democracy. So that's what the book's about. So that's a bit of a shaggy dog story, but there you go. That's how it all happened.
I love it. It speaks to me, I think, at a fundamental level as somebody who long worked in neuroscience, which we think of as, you know, a field where data are king. You know, like a kind of a hard, wet lab science. And then moving over into now I'm studying clinical psychology, where the social sciences equally rely on robust data, yet there's often a different mentality that's taken towards the social sciences, as if they're, you know, more squishy, as if they are incapable of utilizing evidence in the same way. Yet, as you mentioned, evidence-based policy, like when we look at political science, that we look at actual functioning government, evidence-based policy will always, in my view, be the ideal way to go. If we're able to look at the data that we have collected appropriately and utilize that, we can invest our you know, money in the right places, and we can make sure, as you mentioned, that we count people and those people are able to be in the algorithm. Unfortunately, and this is kind of a question for you before we even get into the meat of the book, that's not really how we govern in this country, is it? Or at least not always, not usually.
Well, you know, that's a great way. So I think you kind of identified three issues. One is the difficulty of data in the social sciences. And then kind of how many factors you have to think about in social sciences, which makes it much squishier in some ways than the domain sciences. And then the third is actually the use of the data. So let me talk about each one of those. The first one is it's very difficult to get data on human beings, much more difficult than, you know, in a wet lab, because they're confidential. And so, you know, rule number one is you have to protect the confidentiality of human subjects. Then the second thing is, in many of the life sciences and physical sciences, it's possible to run control experiments.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's really hard to run control experiments in the social sciences. And, you know, to some extent, if you think about the COVID discussions going on right now, there are so many other confounding factors. Even though so much of the transmission of the virus seems to be behavioral, you know, the life sciences contributed, but behavioral, social and behavioral sciences are a big player here. There are so many confounding factors, it's very hard to tease out the contribution of specific factors.
Absolutely. The variance is so high when you're talking about people. I think a perfect example of that is this news article that I saw Fox News was covering a lot. And I remember digging deeper into it and being like, oh, Lord, where a woman, a young, healthy woman, died a few days after getting her second COVID jab. And you read that all these people are relating it to the vaccine. And then when you actually see the quotes from the public health officials, from the coroner, from the epidemiologists, they say it's only temporally related. She did die a few days after getting this jab. There is no evidence yet to link it to that. And the problem is, when this many people are getting vaccinated, tens of millions, eventually hundreds of millions of people, some people are going to die after getting vaccinated just by chance, because some people were going to die on that day.
That's exactly right. And so that goes to the third thing, which is, you know, you kind of need to educate people to go beyond a sample size of one, right? and make use of it for evidence-based policy. And I think you're quite right that, you know, there are a lot of stories where governments don't pay attention. But at the end of the day, you do get some really compelling examples where the use of evidence makes a difference. Would it help to give an example, or, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so let's take something like child abuse. You know, there are millions of kids every year who are abused in the United States. And the challenge is for social programs to and child protective services to figure out, you know, one of two things. When a complaint gets made, the case manager, when a call comes in and the neighbor says, or the doctor says, or the policeman says, or the teacher says, I think the kid's being abused, you've got really limited resources and you've got lots of calls coming in. So the person who is taking the call from Child Protective Services has to make a decision. Do I send Child Protective Services out and potentially take a kid away from a loving home? Or if the information's incorrect, or do I not send a someone out and potentially leave a kid to be abused and potentially die. And so they've got to make a gut decision based on just the simple call coming in. Because of confidentiality, they don't know if the police calling in, I can't link the data to the doctor or the teacher or the neighbor's call in because, you know, basically, as Leanna Wynn from Baltimore said, they only share the files when the kid is dead. So there's a very forward-thinking county in Pennsylvania, Allegheny County, which is Pittsburgh. And so what they did was they were allowed to combine data from all these different aspects, and they aggregated it into a predictive model, not of any individual, but created a predictive score so that when there was a call in to the Child Protective Services, you would have an indicator on a scale of 1 to 20 of how at risk the kid was based on data. In conjunction with the case manager's own expertise. And that really improved the incorrect decisions made in both ways and reduced the racial disparity because, you know, we all have our own biases and to some extent it was able to mitigate the unconscious bias that some of the case managers might have been exhibiting.
Of course. Yeah, that we know from psychology
from
studies
psychology.
That we all have those unconscious biases and they do make their way in. And it's what a fascinating example and what a perfect kind of description of this core, I guess, thesis of the book and of the work that you do that if it's like, I mean, we've all heard this before. We remember hearing this when we took our, you know, elementary school math courses that like kind of garbage in, garbage out. If you get good data early, you have so much more that you can do with it. You have so many more policy changes that you can make. You can make more informed decisions, and it can really fundamentally affect individuals' lives. And as you mentioned, it's also like, there's good data is social justice.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, just in that particular example, when you have an example of data informing evidence, it spreads. So that data informed evidence then informed policy. And that Allegheny County example has really affected thinking throughout the country. So, you know, and certainly affected how people are treated. There's other examples. You know, the Arnold Foundation did a lot of research on cash bails, and they showed what an impact, negative impact cash bail was having on the outcomes for particularly African Americans who were held and then couldn't get out, couldn't work. They just fell into a spiral. And that research and that evidence has changed the way in which we do bail in this country. There have been so many examples of where data has made a huge difference.
Oh, I love that. When I first saw the book and I started to learn more about the concepts and the topics in the book and kind of as we mentioned, the sort of quote central thesis, the first thing that came up for me, and I thought it might be important for the people listening to the show right now was, you know, I don't know, as a scientific skeptic and as somebody who's kind of sometimes a bit polemical and bad about going like, let's find the flaws. The first thing that I thought was, wait, big data in corporate America scares the shit out of me. So the argument here is if the government can do big data the way that corporate America has been so innovative in doing it, we'll probably be in a better place because our data will be better. Like it'll be front and center of our minds. We'll be able to utilize it. But there's that nefarious side to collecting data. And so I wanted to first kind of I don't know, make clear in the conversation exactly what you're talking about when it comes to big data.
So I think,
if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense. And okay. I do want to be clear. We have, because we're dealing with data on human beings, we have to be super careful, right? Because, you know, government isn't always good, right? There's all kinds of examples in which government data has been used for bad. In the 1940s, census data was used to round up Japanese Americans and put them in internment camps. And we've got examples of Arab Americans after 9/11. So, and in a number of the less developed countries in which I've worked, you can see how data can be used, government data can be used for bad.
Right. And we think about, you know, we think about China, present day China, where individuals are all on WeChat, which is not just their social media, but it's also all of their comms, all of their financial data, everything is in this one app. And the government is capable. I mean, we saw, for example, that post-COVID, there were some really innovative and really brilliant ways to shut down spread of the virus. But at the same time, obviously, it's that big question versus it's, you know, convenience versus privacy.
Exactly. So I think, you know, we're always trying to trade off the risk and the utility. What I think is important, and the reason I talk about democratizing our data, is that those decisions have to be, to some extent, much more transparent. The advantage of a public government approach is one can get transparency, clearly not of the data itself, but of the algorithms that are being developed, of the way it's being used. And that was kind of where I could end up at the end, which is the notion that we should have a Manhattan Project for data, that it's far too important to just leave to ad hoc decision making or a small group of government bureaucrats. So it needs to be much more democratically, the processes need to be much more democratically accountable and transparent. And I talk about a number of ways of doing that. And the way in which the algorithms themselves are implemented, that needs to be tested for bias and for fairness and for the way it's being used, so there's some accountability.
Yeah, so that concept of democratizing data is really a multi-layered concept. It's democratizing who are the key kind of constituents, who are the individuals who are making decisions, how is the data collected, how is the data used, and what are the ways in which the data themselves can then, I don't know, downstream or like in some sort of feedback loop, improve the democratic process.
Well, I think that's right. And everything, so where you've been heading throughout is everything has to be driven by the value proposition. So you can't talk about the risk without talking about the utility. And so, you know, and I think we're now at a stage where prior, you know, 30 years ago, the only way to protect the data was, you know, to have it in Washington and secure computers and so on. But nowadays, there's so much more security in the cloud with the right protocols and so on. So it doesn't need to be controlled by just a few people. There can be a whole new way of thinking about data access and use that will promote utility. And let me give you another example, if you'll bear with me for a second. So think about the unemployment data. So I'm a labor economist, right? So I'm very much influenced by jobs and the data on jobs and workers and earnings. So think about unemployment data. So right now, the data on unemployment and employment are captured by a monthly survey of 60,000 households. And it's done very well, obviously, by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And on the first Friday of every month, a national unemployment rate is announced, and with great fanfare. They've had a lot of problems for reasons that are obvious. The pandemic has messed things up, both the measurement and the capture of the data. But stop for a minute and think about whether that is useful right now. If we think about what is useful right now, there's huge variation in jobs and unemployment by race, by sex, by education, by local geography. And it's changing over time and for individuals. And you want to look at individual behavior over time. Those data, it would make sense to be able to track at a very local level, very detailed level, so that, you know, you can design policies around it. But let me give you an analogy. In 1900, the data on weather was controlled in Washington, D.C. And there was a storm heading for the United States, and they thought it was going to land in Florida. Well, it actually landed in Galveston, Texas. And, you know, 6,000 Americans died. And after that, they changed the way in which data were collected and made available. So what happened was there were local collection stations and, around airports and different throughout the country, so that every hour you could figure out what the precipitation is, what the temperature is, what the wind pressure is, the local newspaper and the local television station, you know, their weather information regularly. They don't announce a national temperature on the first Friday of every month.
Right.
So by analogy, we are perfectly capable of developing a system in which we capture information about the dynamics of the local jobs and get that information out so that local people can address local questions and, you know, have the standards and the benchmarks at the national level, just like we do with the National Weather Service, but that the implementation can be local. And that can go to opioid epidemics. When I ask people, last example, when I ask people, where do you get your information about coronavirus? They don't say the CDC. They'll talk about the local television, the local paper, the local blog site, because, you know, you're trying to make decisions about what to do based on local conditions. That's where we need to go.
I want to know, what's the ICU capacity now? Where am I going to get my vaccine? When am
you
I?
You got eligible? It.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because, of course, what we're talking about is context, not just raw data, but, you know, as we often do in the sciences and especially in the social sciences, let's say I'm giving a neuropsychological evaluation to a patient. I'm not going to then write a report and deliver that report to the person who ordered the tests from me with just raw numbers in it. I'm going to interpret those numbers. I'm going to put them in context, say, compared to other people, this person's age, they're functioning in the high average range. This is what that might mean for your patient, which is, you know, fundamentally important. And same thing with the weather data. I might look and say, oh, it's 40 degrees outside, but if it says feels like 32, I'm going to dress differently. And that's important for me. The problem, or I guess the question, comes in with when we're talking about government and we're talking about, you know, here's that big word, bureaucracy. The question comes in, which is just like that weekly or that monthly report or quarterly of you know, unemployment numbers or a weekly benchmark that's delivered, you know, with regard, you know, no context, no relevancy, just this random kind of garbage dump of data, which is the bad way. It's the problematic way. I sometimes worry that for something to become systematized, for something to become policy, especially on the collection end, not so much on the dissemination end, but on the collection end, it's not keeping up with the times. It's not contextualizable. It becomes this heavy, bloated mechanism that we just do because we've always been doing it, because it actually takes that long just to get it into play.
What a great comment. Yeah. So, one of the points in the book is that much of our federal statistical system that produces public data was developed in the 1930s. So our measure of GDP came out of the Great Depression. Our measure of unemployment came out of 1937. And David Card has this great article on the unemployment measurement without theory. And, don't get me wrong, we desperately need public data for all the reasons I've talked about. We want to enable small businesses to make decisions and students looking for jobs to make decisions and figure out where to put hospitals and schools. So there's a massive need for high quality public data. It's just that, and the federal statistical system that pays such good attention to measurement and quality. It's just I think we need to rethink the whole way in which we collect and produce data. And in the book, I open up by saying I was having lunch with one of the top statisticians in the United States, and the conversation turned to why aren't we getting any change? We've known about the problems for 40 years, and nothing ever changes. Why doesn't it change? And that's why I think we need disruptive change. It doesn't mean that I'm not a supporter of public data and federal statistics. I just absolutely think there needs to be a disruptive change in the way in which we collect and make use of data.
So here's kind of like something that's coming up in my mind. It's a metaphor, maybe. See if you can stay with me on this. See if you guys can stay with me on this, because I'm going to kind of be constructing it as I go. But this reminds me, this kind of core problem, the squeamishness around this, reminds me of an issue that I often deal with in the science communication arena around genetically modified organisms. So I'll often hear people who are very squeamish about GMOs. And when I start to really investigate and carve with them out what it is that they're squeamish about, it actually comes down to other moral questions about patenting seeds, about monocropping, about other agricultural practices that are not intrinsic to GMOs and are actually often done in conventional farming. And the actual genetic modification is not the concern, but all those things become sort of amalgamated, and it's very and so ultimately you hear that people want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I don't want GMOs because X, Y, and Z. Well, none of those things actually have to do with genetic modification. The core fundamental practice of genetic modification has these like incredible outcomes. And once we start to tease those things out, usually the argument starts to become more nuanced and to change. And I wonder if people at their core are squeamish about collecting data at a governmental level the way that Google and Facebook do, because we can't get past the kind of immoral or value judgment or the advertising, the financial, the for-profit motive of Google and Facebook.
That is a great comment. So I think you're right. I've thought about this a lot. Now, I'm not an expert in human beings' feelings, right? I'm an economist, so almost by definition, I don't have any, right? So, but I think people are very worried, and quite in many cases, quite rightly so, about the pervasive use of data to make money off us in the private sector. Although, when it comes down to it, I don't know about you, but I tried to disable my location finder in Google Maps, and it just drove me crazy after a while. I use it all the time, so it's fine if they know me. Happy to, and I'm happy to get 10% off at the supermarket even though I know that's going to, they're going to track me. So, you know, we kind of make this Faustian bargain, but there's actually a whole lot more guardrails on the federal government than there are in the private sector. But I do think people do conflate that. And I think the challenge has got to be what I started off by saying with Google and the supermarket. I'm willing to trade off some privacy for because of the value proposition. I'm actually willing to get tracked to preserve my health with the coronavirus, right? You saw a really sharp change in people's behavior. So where I think the importance of the democratizing our data is if we start with the value proposition, then there will be much more acceptance of public data. So if I say, I want to be able to know where you are so that if there's a hurricane, I can get you out of harm's way, so that I don't waste your money in putting a school in the wrong place, so that I can get help to people who are addicted to opioids and intervene before their lives are destroyed. There has to be that so that. And where I what I make the argument in the book is, we have the federal system has forgotten how to produce value. And if we start with the value, this is what small business needs, what students need, it's what we need to protect children. If we start with that, then that and make that value trade-off much clearer, then we're going to get to a different place. I think the problem is that quite frankly, the system has become so ossified and so used to producing sausages that were in demand in 1937.
Yeah. Nobody wants anymore.
No one wants it anymore. So there are many more things that people want. So how do we innovate and create things that people want? How do we readjust the incentives? I'm an economist. How do we readjust the incentives? And how do we produce things that people want at the local level? And that again, is what the book is about.
Right. And, you know, I think two things come up for me as you mentioned that. This value proposition, this why, this kind of in an effort to increase public safety, you know, we would like to know X, Y, and Z. In an effort to improve the ability to have incentives for, you know, individuals who are doing these different things, we need to know what these things are. That is fundamental, right? This is so important, and this is the core of the book. I think the concern is this sort of second half of the sentence, which I know that I need to hear, and I need my concerns calmed, which is, and we won't sell this information, and we won't use this information for nefarious purposes, and this information is not going to be kept in some depository where later individuals are going to be able to make policy decisions based on their nefarious purposes. And that's the part that I think makes some people squeamish. And I think a continuation of that question, and I'll say it out loud on the show because, you know, this is my show and everybody kind of knows where I stand. I am a bloody gushy heart liberal. Like I am super ultra progressive in my views. And so I am all about, you know, I'm hook, line, and sinker reading your book and saying, yep, agree. But I can't help but channel my like Trump, you know, hat wearing Republican right. father who's like, you better not come after my guns and you better not, you know, tread on me. And that is a hard proposition for individuals who literally are like anti-online shopping. Some of the basic fundamental conveniences that giving up a little bit of privacy offer, I feel like there's always going to be this holdover of people who are like, I don't want to give my data up for any reason. I don't want to participate in the census. I don't care about the global good.
That's
true. It scares
me.
Yeah.
That's true. And, you know, that's part of a healthy dialogue, I think. I mean, don't tell my husband, but I'm not always right. So I think I respect the, in principle, that people can have different views. What I am going to say is that what I propose in the book is actually should make your father feel more comfortable, given that we do have to collect data in order to make better use of the taxpayer's dollar. So Patty Murray, who's the a Democratic senator, and Paul Ryan, who was obviously Speaker of the House, on the Republican side, they're the ones who partnered to get this whole evidence-based policy moving forward. And I think Patty Murray said it exactly right. You could be for more government, or you could be for less government, but we should all be for better government. So to the extent that data makes government more efficient, and of course, you don't have to have names and social security numbers. It can all be de-identified. So the data don't need to be about you as an individual. You're not having a bunch of data sloshing around. It's only for approved projects. So it's the five safes, safe projects. Only for approved projects that have been deemed to have value. Safe people. Limited number of people working on it, also approved, sworn, and indemnified. Safe settings in a secure environment, in this case, which is FedRAMPed, which is, you know, in a vault, basically patrolled by barbed wire and dogs. I kid you not. Safe data, so the data are de-identified and hashed, so there's no social security numbers and names.
So even if there was some sort of hack or something, you wouldn't be able to track it back to the people.
Correct. Well, it would obviously nowadays nothing is anonymized, but the point is the data are striped. So they're not even in one place. They're striped in different places and they're only brought together for analysis. So it's not like there's this little flag saying this is one data set. It's like, as my cloud friend says, it's like a snowman that has melted and it's very difficult to pull the snowman back together. And then the last thing is safe export. So no individual level data released, it's aggregated before it's released. So those five safes. And what I think is going to be so important, again, I recommend it in the book, is it should be in an institution that is separate from the federal government. So,
like some sort of bipartisan committee.
An actual, like the Manhattan Project, like a national lab.
Right. Okay. Yeah, where it's funded by the federal government, but there are, you know, everyday citizens working there with
That's
security
right.
clearance. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. With security clearance. So, treat it like Department of Defense or Department of Energy National Labs, where we have our troop movements abroad and we have nuclear secrets and all kinds of national security in a secure lab. We could do the same thing for data on human subjects.
Yeah.
So
and we don't do that now, do we?
No. It's much more dangerous the way it's done now because it's all ad hoc. People don't have standard rules. You have researchers who, as you well know, who have data, you know, on their desktop or on their laptop and don't observe security protocols. Much safer to have a national lab approach.
Also, when the data collection and analysis is at higher levels of government, sort of that there's not that disconnect like at a national lab, what you also end up with, sadly, and it was never the intention, but we saw it during the last administration, is a sort of politicization of historically non-political entities. We saw policy that was put in place in an effort to either gag or to open up information that was never meant to be gagged or opened up. And we saw individuals who were just trying to do their jobs feeling like they were caught in some sort of chess game. And that should never happen.
It was mind-boggling. And, you know, I'm a huge fan of, I'm like you, right? I'm a huge fan of civil servants. I've been around the federal government for, you know, close on 25 years now. Almost all of them are, you know, hardworking. I know your father is probably rolling his eyes. They're doing this for the public good. They do not get paid very well. So, you know, and to see that ethos getting challenged was a worry.
Absolutely. I mean, and you know, we saw the conflicts at the FBI, for example. We saw the conflicts at the CIA, but seeing these conflicts at the EPA, at the CDC, like, I mean, all of it was worrisome. The Census Bureau, it was heartbreaking.
Department of Justice.
Heartbreaking. And really does kind of pull at the fundamental sense of security that those of us who try to stay abreast of this stuff tend to maintain in our democracy. And so building or at least codifying or fostering, as you talk about, institutions that are bipartisan, that are separate, that are evidence-based, and that are, you know, informed by social justice, I think, you know, maybe I shouldn't even use that term because sadly that term has been co-opted as well, but who are informed and driven by civil service.
That's
so important.
And then, you know, the thing is, instead of numbers coming out of a secretive process, it is a process whereby there is external replication and validation of the results. So there are other. So the whole point of a national lab like the Manhattan Project was you can have both government agency staff and external scientists collaborating together. So you've got the best of the best in terms of scientists, best of the best in terms of government agency staff, producing data for the public good.
Right. And only in the case of protecting identity or in the case of national security, only caveated by the cases of national security and personal identity, everything else is transparent.
Correct.
That's important, right. That there's peer review, right? That other individuals are able, like laboratories or universities are able to make sure that this data is being utilized the right way, contribute their own modeling, contribute their own interpretations so that everything becomes more robust, not more fractured.
Exactly. And right now, the challenge has been, and that goes back to your earlier comment about social science being seen in some cases as a lesser science, and it's been the lack of reproducibility and replicability because the last refuge of a scoundrel is confidentiality.
Oh, exactly.
So, the point is, we now have the technologies to protect the data and promote access at the same time. And that's that five safes approach that we talked about.
Yeah, Julia, gosh, there's so much even more that we could talk about. We're running low on time, unfortunately. But in a way, that's great, because obviously I want people to pick up the book and read about this themselves. But before we say goodbye, I was hoping that I could put you a little bit on the spot and ask you the same two questions that I ask all of my guests. I am just kind of tremendously interested in your perspective with regards to these kind of core questions that everybody grapples with. You okay with that? You can take as much time as you need.
Sure.
Okay. All right. So here they are. When we think about the future, when you personally think about the future, in whatever context is relevant to you kind of in this moment, so this could be personal life, this could be academic, your vocation, or it could be much larger, you know, global kind of context, or even a cosmic context. The first question is, what is the thing that's keeping you up the most at night? What are you legitimately concerned about? Maybe even pessimistic or a bit cynical about? What are you like fundamentally worried about when it comes to the future? But on the flip side of that, so we end on a more positive note, I'm wondering, what are you kind of authentically and truly optimistic about? What are you looking forward to and hopeful for?
Those are great questions. So on the most pessimistic side, I'm going to say it's been a really tough 4 years.
Yes. You're here.
So obviously, I'm not an American, and I married an American, and I never actually decided to live in this country. It was just he didn't want to go back to New Zealand, so I'm a New Zealander.
And I thought I recognized your accent, but it sounds New Zealander, but like New Zealander light. It's not as severe as many. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
It's a mess because actually I'm English born and my mother's Swedish, so my first language was Swedish. Gotcha. And then we emigrated to New Zealand when I was a kid and now I'm married a Yank, so it's a mess.
And how long have you lived here in the States?
Oh, a long time. Yes, I married him, which has been far too long, as we'll both tell you. but, you know, over time, and, you know, as you are probably aware, not everyone is as enthralled with the United States. And I certainly came here only for a year and then kind of stayed. And but over time living here, I particularly learning more about the country and how it worked and, you know, going to Gettysburg and learning about the Civil War and the Revolutionary War. And there was so much to like. I mean, there's still a lot of things not to like, not just clear, but there were so many things to like. And when Obama was elected, you know, I was so proud to have a directly elected black male. It was
and
just
one who is plenty progressive to boot.
Yeah. Well, there is that. Yeah. But you know, that spoke volumes. And then over the past 4 years, I also respect many to the right. I respect their views. I think reasonable people can disagree and have a different value system. We actually all think about the same things. We just weight the things differently. And that's fine. But I got very pessimistic about the dialogue. And I think on both sides, there's and I think it was precipitated by the president.
Mm-hmm.
And it pushed both sides to a level of rhetoric and not being able to talk to each other that I thought was awful for this country, just awful. But I see it happening in other countries, so it's clearly not unique. So that keeps me up at night. Why am I optimistic? Oh, you know, we've been through a lot worse. There is so much good in people. You can see so many good things happening. I fundamentally think human beings are good. And there's a natural backlash, and the pendulum will swing back. So, you know, I think we'll be all right. And I have faith in science, and I have faith in people, and we'll muddle through. My parents lived through World War II. And even you think World War I, not my parents, but my grandparents, they went through 1914 to 18 war and all that blood and guts and then the Spanish flu and then, you know, and the world didn't end. We all just muddle through and there's so much joy in life that I don't want to focus in on the bad stuff.
And it did. You're right. It got better. You know, I think that
it got better.
those of us who I'm in my late 30s, so I'm sort of on that cusp between millennial and Gen Y. I don't even know whatever it's called. And I find that when we look at sort of the anti-vax rhetoric, or when we look at some of the mentalities that can frustrate those of us who work as science communicators and those of us who work in public policy, we often forget that a lot of it comes down to the safety and the security of the world that we've lived in today, that our memories are short, although mm-hmm. history is long. And of course, we know that the moral arc of the universe does bend towards justice. It's only gotten better.
Yes. You think about, you know, the Dark Ages, you know, 100 you know, plagues that got rid of one third of the population. My goodness. And my father and my Uncle John, who went through World War II in Bristol in the bombing. And, you know, we are such wusses about, oh, we have to stay at home. Like, what? They would have said, you guys are so soft. And we have the internet. We have food, you know. We have more clothes.
We didn't have to change our lifestyles that much at all.
Yeah. We, what was our biggest problem? We got fatter. So, you know, it'll be, as they say in the South, which I've learned, it'll be just fine, honey child.
That's right, love.
Why, bless your heart, although I've learned not to say that.
Bless your heart. Yeah, I was born and raised in Texas, so I know the drill.
Oh, there you go. So you know what? I was told what my bless your heart meant after several people had said it to me, and then I'm like, oh, really?
Yeah, it's kind of like the very British.
It's insulting, yeah.
Yeah, it's the very British way to do like the kind of flat compliment, which is actually not a compliment at all. Oh gosh, Julia, this has been not just so much fun, but so informative. And I think it's really sparked a lot of questions, a lot of discussions. You know, this is one of those topics that exists sort of below our conscious awareness for most Americans. And I always am thrilled to have these kinds of conversations on the show. Obviously, clearly, many of the episodes of Talk Nerdy that I do are about things that are right in the forefront of people's minds. I think this is such a perfect example of something that should be in the forefront of our minds, something that affects us in the day-to-day, but we almost never think about. So I just want to thank you for bringing this important kind of these important questions, these important concerns, and these important initiatives out into the daylight so that we could discuss them in a kind of clear and evidence-based way.
Well, back at you. It's been a joy chatting to you too, and hope you can help us democratize our data because it's fundamental.
Absolutely.
Thank Everyone, you again.
Thank you. The book is Democratizing Our Data, A Manifesto by Dr. Julia Lane. We thank Julia for joining us today, and everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.